Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 063045, United States of America versus Dale and Harris, appellant. Mr. Katzoff, the appellant, and Ms. Jackson, the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, Howard Katzoff, on behalf of appellant Dale Ann Harris. Ms. Harris is alleged that the district court violated her constitutional right to an impartial jury by asking compound voir dire questions. The compound voir dire questions, there were, I believe, seven, the most significant perhaps being the standard law enforcement employment question as to past and present employment by any friends, any family members, close friends, or the jurors in law enforcement fields, including the law enforcement agency that was responsible for investigating this particular case. Other two-part questions were asked, which also infringed on the ability to determine or expose potential prejudice and bias of the jurors, had to do with whether the jurors participated in neighborhood watch, which oftentimes implicates contact with law enforcement and is often revealed in follow-up questions, whether they served as grand jurors, in which the service extends for long periods of times with direct contact with law enforcement officers, sometimes the same officers, over an extended period of time, which you don't normally get in petit service. Study of law and service on criminal trials all impact oftentimes in follow-up questions as to bias and prejudice in areas that are important in a criminal trial, extremely important in a trial where law enforcement credibility, reliability of the police work is at issue, as it was in this case. I would submit that this case is very close to the Little John case.
The government says it's more like West.
Well, I would submit it's more like Little John in that it is a search warrant case, like Little John, which means it is not the same sort of overwhelming type of case, a one-on-one recovery of an item from a bag directly from an individual, directly attributed to an individual. This is a search warrant, shared occupancy, items recovered in a common area, question as to knowledge, exercise of dominion and control, the normal constructive possession issues.
On the key voir dire question, the one you argue about mostly in your brief, that is the question that got at the jurors' current employment information and whether they write that question.
Well, current and past.
Yeah, but here defense counsel had that information, which makes it more like West.
Well, I submit that that West and this case are far different, and it's closer to Little John in the respect that what you seem to know based on one comment from the judge during the voir dire is that there was a list of employment as to the jurors. That is pretty standard, and likely the same type of list was there in West and in Little John.
In Little John there was no indication at all that there had been a list.
Well,
there was nothing.
That's true. The record was void on that issue.
Well, that was a major distinction between the Little John court made between it and West.
That's true.
Right.
But the similarity and the significance is that in both Little John and this case, you don't know whether you have the accurate present information as to each one. You just know that there's a list. Two, you don't know past employment information of any of the jurors, which is part of the question that the trial counsel tried to have asked, and which is very pertinent. Somebody could have a job for 2 months as a security guard, as a grocery clerk, and could have worked for Metropolitan Police Department for 20 years.
Am I wrong that defense counsel didn't ask for the past employment information in this case?
In the pretrial voir dire, you're correct that it did not specifically ask.
Right.
During the voir dire process, the trial counsel approached and asked that the past and prior employment question be asked with regard to, in not a two-part fashion, with regard to the jurors. So they did make a request during the trial, although there had not been a pretrial request, which is what I think the government referred to in its reply to my supplemental brief on this issue. And I would submit that that is sufficient to trigger and preserve the issue that there was a request for the past employment. So Little John, in this case, are in terms of the important and relevant and salient factors that go to bias and prejudice, neither one of them were they able to discern any past employment with regard to the jurors, the family members of the jurors, and the close friends of the jurors, regardless of whether there was a list which may have had some information regarding the very current jobs of the jurors. That doesn't answer the question of bias and prejudice that was addressed at Little John and leaves just a broad area that that was not inquired into, that the court is inquired into in a case such as this where law enforcement issues are at stake in a criminal trial, and for the same types of reasons that it was determined that the trial court's inquiry was not sufficient to flush out those real types of prejudices that this circuit has recognized. It should have been done in this case, and it requires the same result as the Little John case.
Wasn't the officer's credibility much more significant in Little John than it is here, though?
Well, one officer's credibility, I think, was perhaps more at issue in Little John than it was in here. But a number of officers' credibility and the seizing officer's credibility was probably just as at issue, in that it's very unusual the way the police were able to try to convey an impression that there was PCP smelling contraband all over the place, when in fact virtually all but two of the items tested negative for the first substance of PCP. And so the credibility of the officer that says every item I picked up and seized smelled like this strong chemical odor of PCP.
Wait, didn't both glass vials test positive for PCP?
Both?
Yeah.
There were two vials that tested positive.
Right, and then there was one that broke.
Substance in a jar. The jar broke.
No, there were three vials, right?
Three vials in
and one broke.
Correct.
And all three tested positive.
Well, the three vials were commingled in the sense that they were all put together. And one broke, and so that there was liquid mixed in with the other two vials. There was questioning to suggest that perhaps the integrity of that evidence and which one had PCP was called into question.
But didn't two of the vials that didn't break both test positive?
That's the testimony of the chemist was that that each of them tested positive.
Well, if the two uncompromised ones tested positive, then what difference does it make if the third one might have been compromised?
Well, to me, the significance is that all of these items were not in plain view. All the items that were tested and tested positive, I believe two were in the freezer. One was supposed to be in towards the front of the freezer that you would see. Whether it's evident that it's contraband or not is very unclear. The other were in the back and concealed. Others were on the shelves with many, many, many items, and it's unclear whether anybody would, whether Ms. Harris would have known they were there. So the issue really is in terms of knowledge, exercise of dominion and control, did she know they were there? These were not plain view items. So regardless of whether it tested positive or not, It has to do with the credibility of the officers trying to convey this impression that everything there was related to PCP, when in fact very few of the items actually were. And that was an important, really a critical issue for Ms. Harrison's
case. There's tinfoil and parsley in plain view, right?
That's correct, and it tested, as far as you can tell from the record, every one of those items tested negative. I don't know if it was parsley, but some material it was described as. And every one of those items tested negative. So what they were, whether it had something to do with hair care, whether it had something to do, the record is very unclear, but the officers were permitted to make that appear as if it was completely a PCP place, when in fact, you know, that's an issue of credibility as to those officers that testified. And that's the significance to me of assuring a fair and impartial jury that has been weeded out with regard to potential law enforcement bias. We know that people with biases don't immediately recognize their biases. They think they're fair, in spite of the fact that we have come to realize in follow-up questioning that their idea of fairness simply isn't fair to the participants of this particular trial. And so there are significant issues of credibility, regardless of the fact that the vials tested positive. Those were items that were concealed, and it's unclear whether Ms. Harris knew they were there.
Let me ask you a question about the Miranda issue.
Yes.
The government says that even if you're right that there's a Fifth Amendment problem here, that the error was harmless. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is sort of the flip side of the cases that are cited or the reason that the government always wants to elicit testimony that from their experts and whatnot, that where there's drugs, there's often guns. And so an admission with regard to guns can be imputed in reverse, so to speak, to suggest that then Ms. Harris must have known about the about the drugs, and therefore I would submit that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to find that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of the sufficiency arguments I've already somewhat addressed in terms of that this case wasn't overwhelming. It's a constructive possession search warrant case, and the fact that whenever you inject that issue of guns and drugs together,
of course, the guns were admitted into evidence. It's just the statement that was suppressed.
It's a statement of knowledge as to their location, which is...
So what did that add to it, since the guns were already in? Her knowledge of the guns?
And her knowledge that the guns were in the apartment, which goes to, in reverse, perhaps, permit jurors to infer that if she knew the guns were there, she knew the drugs were there. And so the statement becomes prejudicial in that
respect. Right. It helped defeat any suggestion that she was oblivious to... Right.
Correct. That's the prejudice that we see.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Sarah Chasson on behalf of the United States.
What's your response to this very last point that counsel made on your harmless error argument, and that is that the knowledge of the guns could have been significant in the jury's mind?
The view of the government is, as we stated in our briefs, that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt for several reasons.
Yeah.
And that is not only the overwhelming strength of the government's evidence on the direct issue of whether she possessed with intent to distribute the PCP, and that evidence took numerous forms, including the fingerprint evidence, the plain view characteristics of it, the fact that it was her house and she was at home, but also the use to which the government put the gun evidence at trial. We made only passing reference in our closing argument. There was no significant effort to use the guns in any way.
Well, it's the last part of the closing argument right before, it's there.
It is there, but I believe
and
it was...
And it's in the opening argument.
And
they're both short.
It was half of a sentence in the government's closing argument. It was the bulk of our closing, and I don't believe it was referred to again in our rebuttal argument either.
Correct.
The bulk of the government's theory was that there was sufficient and overwhelming direct knowledge of her intent to possess and distribute with the intent to possess PCP. And we really focused the jury's attention on the fingerprint evidence, the quantity of the drugs that was available. There were between 600 and 1,100.
But the statement was the one thing that defeated the idea that she was oblivious to this, that perhaps it was Harrington or Brown, Ms. Harrington or Mr. Brown's operation, and that she was oblivious to it. That kind of went out the window once you had her statement about the guns.
Yes, the statement had some value. This is why we sought to have it introduced into evidence. It had some value. But in the context of the government's case, there is no reasonable danger that the jury would have seized upon that statement as the sole basis.
What do you think the right Chapman standard is? And there's a debate about whether it's contribute to the jury or you subtract what was presented to the jury improperly and just look at the other evidence. Government have a position on that 40 years after Chapman?
40 years after Chapman, the government does not have a precise view on that standard, except to say that under either one, we're okay. Except to say that under either view, we would be okay in this case, given the strength of the government's evidence. I mean, it's unusual to recover a fingerprint from a glass vial that contains...
Well, couldn't the fingerprint... There's one fingerprint, right? One jar of the fingerprint?
One.
Well, couldn't the jar have been used before? I mean, it's common that... You know, if the jar is in the house, it could have been used before.
It could have been, and that was the argument that defense counsel made.
Right.
I don't think that that was a fair inference in light of everything else that was going on in that house. The jury was free to find that, but it's not a reasonable inference given the quantity of the drugs.
And wait, it's not a reasonable inference that her fingerprint could have been on the vial in her house before the drugs were put in them?
In light of the other...
I mean, there was no evidence about when the... Given the fact that there was no evidence about when the fingerprint was put on the vial, right? How could it be unreasonable for the jury to believe that it was pre-PCPs?
It's an available inference that they could have drawn, but in light of the fact that there were numerous other containers in the house that also bore her fingerprints, that smelled of PCP, that there was other paraphernalia that was used that was consistent with the way that PCP is manufactured and distributed in the District of Columbia, including not just the spoons, which are one way of presenting the PCP for sale, but also the jars in which the PCP can be held for dipping in order to sell it. She was linked not just with her ownership and presence and control of the premises, but with the availability of other materials throughout the kitchen, which is also, I would remind the court, a central part of the house. It's not like we're talking about items in plain view in a spare room. We're talking about items in plain view in a central gathering, a common area. It was fair, and the more reasonable view of that fingerprint is to conclude that it was, as the government called it in its closing, her calling card. It was her signature. It was a link that tied her.
Yeah, well, you just said the more reasonable view, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, that sort of answers the question, doesn't it? That means there's another, maybe less reasonable, nevertheless reasonable view.
I will not argue to the court that nobody could ever find that she'd touched it before and it was just left there.
Right.
I just, a fair view of the evidence, and it is more consistent with the evidence, is that it was there during the manufacturing.
Can I ask you about the custody point? What if guns had been drawn?
I think that there, you know, that would be another heightening factor that would have made it more akin to custody. But what we have here...
Well, more akin to? Because I thought your standard in footnote 16 in your brief was that it has to be the same thing as the Fourth Amendment standard, right? And guns drawn doesn't transform necessarily a Terry stop into an arrest, de facto arrest.
No, it doesn't. What I was... trying to also get at is it could be an additional factor among the totality of circumstances that one could look to find that the situation was in fact custodial. But since Officer Cephas's weapon was holstered and he simply took her into the hallway for 30 seconds, really what we have here is nothing more than her handcuffing.
In Quarles, the Supreme Court, which is the public safety case, the Supreme Court first concluded that the Quarles was in custody and Quarles there was surrounded by four police officers and handcuffed, and the Supreme Court took it as a given in that case that there was custody. What do you make of that?
I make of it that there is no custody in this case because we did not have the defendant surrounded by multiple police officers.
I think that was the distinguishing factor then?
I think it is one of the distinguishing factors. I'm not recalling if in Quarles they also announced their purpose for being there. In
right.
this case, I think it
so is... So the distinguishing factor here is that they announced they're there to here to execute the search warrant?
To execute a search warrant. And the question is, from an objective standard, would this person have reasonably believed that they were in custody? And no, they were here to be detained while a search warrant was being executed. And that was that intent was demonstrated by the... you know, the minimal level of intrusion that was necessary in order to keep the officer's safety preserved. And I think it's reasonable that the officers also placed handcuffs upon the people that they found at the house when they came to execute the search warrant.
Well, the question isn't whether that was reasonable, but whether having put handcuffs on the defendant and being taken into another room, a reasonable person would have thought they were under arrest. Right? That's the question. It's not whether it was reasonable. No one's challenging that the cuffing was reasonable here.
But she was only briefly moved into the hallway, I believe it was.
Suppose that she had been taken there for 2 minutes. Would that have made a difference?
The length of the detention is a factor that can reasonably mm-hmm. be used to determine whether somebody's in custody. I disagree that a 2-minute detention under the circumstances here would have amounted to custody because really what we
would have... What about 5 minutes?
You know, you're getting, depending upon what else is going on, I could see circumstances where
that would become custodial. What's the standard you're using? What standard do you have in your mind that made you pause at the 5-minute
because
custody rather than
the
2 minutes?
The reason why I paused is because during mm-hmm. 5 minutes, there is more opportunity for other events to transpire that are not in your hypothetical, which uh-huh. is why I answered it by saying that it could be that under 5 minutes, different circumstances could be present. More officers could be present. They could be using a tone of voice. They could be saying something that transformed the circumstances.
I thought the whole idea was to have clear rules for police in Miranda cases. And your approach here, if you gave it to police officers who were going out to execute search warrants, I think would leave them scratching their heads. What's the clear, I think Judge Tatel's question goes to, what's the clear rule?
Well, I think that the one clear rule that emerges from this court's cases and which we cite in our brief is that what they did here was okay, was take one officer placing handcuffs on a defendant after announcing that they are there to conduct a search and simply asking if there's anything that they should know about is all right.
That's a clear rule? I'll give you a clearer one. How about the rule that if you're cuffed, and the police don't tell you you're not under arrest, then you're in custody for Fifth Amendment purposes. That would be really simple to administer.
It would be simple to administer. I think that that transforms too much into custody. It is not enough. The mere placing in handcuffs while you are there to execute a search warrant should not be enough to make you in custody.
You think the average person actually would think that, would say, well, let's see, they put me under cuffs and they told me that they're here to do a search warrant and therefore it's not equivalent to an arrest?
I think that the average person
Don't you think the average person being cuffed and not being told she wasn't under arrest would think just the opposite?
I disagree.
Really?
I think that mm-hmm. the police are there to conduct an investigatory stop, and certainly in this case, they actually let the other two women go after placing them.
Well, maybe there's a legal fiction, but Judge Tatel's certainly onto something, right? I mean, there's just no way the average person, when the police come into their house, how many officers were in the house here?
Exactly.
How many officers were in the apartment here? There are many.
I'm calling approximately 5.
Okay.
I'm not entirely certain of that.
And the woman's taken, Harris is taken to the other room and handcuffed, and you're saying they wouldn't feel like they're in custody?
No. I think they said they were here to execute a search warrant, and that they were there, and it was, I think, a reasonable person would determine that that was an objective a reasonable protective step to take.
I mean, it seems like your stronger argument is just that there's got to be a bright line here, right? And it's got to be just like a Fourth Amendment arrest, and Fourth Amendment arrest doesn't happen until you've been moved or you've been held for 20 minutes, I guess, if you look at Sharp or cases like that, or longer.
Yes, right? But those are also totality of circumstances questions as well.
So
I'm over my time. Can I make a brief argument on the voir dire question?
Yes, go ahead. Okay. A brief.
Just to make a few factual points. It's the government's view that this case is unlike Little John. The only similarity is that both of them were search warrant cases. Turning directly to Judge Tatel's first point in his question to Mr. Katzhoff, which was, is it true that the proposed voir dire from the defendant didn't seek past employment? I had the opportunity to check the transcript. At page 49 of the September 26 date, defense counsel actually did not request past employment either. So neither in writing nor orally did they request past employment history from the members of the panel. And all of the other circumstances that this court identified in West as sufficient to provide a full and fair voir dire were likewise present here, including the other questions designed to elucidate bias and the credibility of the officers not meaningfully in question.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Katsas have any time left?
No.
You can take 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I didn't get a chance. I was starting to try to look, but my recollection is that at the bench conference where the objection was made, the request was for the two-part question to a question which specifically asks about past and present employment for friends, close friends, family members, and the juror. And I believe it's around page 49 or so of that request is made, which seems to encompass a request for past employment, even though it wasn't made prior. With regard to the statements, I submit that the Chapman standard, whatever is used, that it must find beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict complained of obtained, and based on the arguments I raised, it seems impossible to make that finding if, in fact,
well, that's the one version of Chapman supports you. The other version of Chapman, this is one of the rare cases, perhaps, where how you interpret Chapman may make a difference.
And with regard to custody, I would submit that under the objective standard, any reasonable person would feel that their freedom was curtailed.
Is it your position that whenever anybody's handcuffed, that's sufficient for Fifth Amendment custody purposes?
No. No? I don't think.
So what added it here? What made the difference here?
Here you have number of officers. You have the police action in handcuffing everyone, securing the place, and then isolating the particular individual. The particular individual is the target of the search warrant and the target of the investigation. And the only one present during the search that is an occupant of that particular residence.
So to go back to Judge Kavanaugh's question about looking for a bright line rule, what's your bright line rule here?
Well, courts haven't really established a bright line rule, which has been
we have an opportunity to write an opinion on this.
The courts have seemed to say that the handcuffing in today's world isn't the bright line because it's...
Well, a Terry stop's not enough, right? That's clear.
Berkemer,
that would have been a bright line, actually. If you're seized, then you're in custody. That would have been a bright line. The other bright line that comes from the government's footnote, at least, is if you're not formally arrested or de facto arrested, then it's not custody. So do you have a bright line in between those two?
Well, there's so many factors, but I think that the standard that
handcuffing might be a good bright line for you.
Handcuff is the probably most significant factor here, and the fact that they're not told that they're not under arrest, and that then they're questioned, in a way that they expect or anticipate to elicit an incriminating response. And the officer's subjective views are a factor that can be considered in determining the objective test. And again, regardless of what test is determined, we submit that we have met that test.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Katzoff, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Harris, and we are grateful for your assistance. Thank you. Case is submitted.